Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Paranormal Dimensions is fortnightly on Mondays on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
Ready.
26.
26.
50%.
50%.
Reading.
+2.3.
26 and a quarter.
26 and a quarter.
50%.
50%.
Reading.
+2.4.
Increase 2%.
Increase 2%.
Reading.
+2.48.
Increase slowly to 55.
Increase slowly to 55.
Red alert. 10. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Okay, ready to rock.
Hello, this is Nick Pope, and you're listening to the Paranormal UK Radio Network, the UK's biggest paranormal network. And this is Paranormal Dimensions with David Young.
For me, this is the kind of show that I like doing most, where you basically just have a freewheeling discussion, have a chance to go off on topics. That's what's going to make you an outstanding player in the field. Just keep doing it.
Hello and welcome to the final Paranormal Dimensions show of 2022. Thank you for that introduction, Nick. And also thank you for those kind words, Mr. Peter Robbins, who's our guest today. Now, if you listen to the previous show with Brenda Butler and Philip Kinsella, I'm continuing this theme with the Rendlesham Forest incident anniversary. It's the 42nd anniversary with Peter. At least for a part of the show, Peter was a man who was somewhat the centre of the Rendlesham Forest incident with the book Left at Eastgate with his co-writer. Unfortunately, there were lots of lies found in the book, and Peter disassociated himself completely from his co-writer. That was in 2017. My intention is to try and find out what Peter's been up to over the last few years and how he feels about the Rendlesham Forest incident now. So, here we go with Peter Robbins. Hello, Peter. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be back on, David. How are you doing this evening?
I'm absolutely wonderful. And it's actually great to get you back on the show again. We did a show probably a couple of years ago when you were on about James Forrestal, just before the world went crazy. And I've been lucky enough to actually meet you again last year. Oh, no,
earlier this year.
And
it was May.
Yeah, and I'll be seeing you again next year. In 2023. So it's great that you're coming back again.
I am. I'm looking forward to it already.
Yeah. Did you enjoy your trip over?
Oh, God, yeah.
Silly question, wonderful. Probably.
And Hull was really the end of it in that I came over with my sister Anne, which was great. She had lived in England for 2 years when she was younger. And first stop after London was Suffolk, and a quick visit to the area and time with my dearest friends there, and then up to Lincolnshire. With friends there, and then on to Hull, back to London. But it was a great conference. It was a terrific conference, and all credit due to Chris Evers and his brother and the wonderful team of people that put it together. They did
Chris does really
job.
Well. And I bet it was great seeing the Warnocks again, because you've obviously you've stayed there with them many times over the years in Suffolk. And how are they? Are they still keeping well?
They're getting on, and they will be moving from where they live now in a village in Suffolk to Woodbridge.
All right.
But they it was absolutely incredible to see them again. And, you know, we all use the phrase such and such is like family to us, but this family really is family, along with my own, and I absolutely adore them. Yeah.
Well, it would be. It must be, what, probably nearly 30 years you've known them now, isn't it?
We met in February of 1988.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to add it up in my mind. It's quite a long time ago, anyway.
Yeah, it is.
But, I mean, how do you feel about the... I mean, I don't really want to ask you any sort of leading questions or anything, Peter, but how do you feel about the way things have gone with the Rendlesham story over the years now?
When the whole scandal with Left at Eastgate broke, and I spent a year or so publicly doing what I could to account as well as I could for what had happened, I hit a point that I had never had with any other UFO case I had investigated. This one, of course, for several decades, so kind of in a class by itself. But I simply hit a point where I realized it was a real series of incidents, of course. The authentic witnesses, of course, like,
and your research into it was still to be appreciated. So
yeah, I think it's a shame, and I absolutely understand it, why some people categorically simply hate the book, many of whom haven't read it. With the understanding that there are hundreds of absolutely fact-checked, annotated, footnoted parts of the book. I stand by my account, except where I was completely misled. And if one can read it or reread it and know that you just don't know, it can be a tiny thing or a major thing that my co-author is simply not telling the truth about.
Yeah. I mean, I've got three copies on my shelf here, which I'm still very proud of, and your section of it is actually to be, you know, commended. There's all that is, you know, the best word I can use for it.
Well, I've been through worse, you know, when you look at your life and after what aspects of depression, humiliation, writer's block, embarrassment accompanied it, you get on with things. You certainly take responsibility, but you get on with things. And my point being that I guess 2017, I realized I needed to walk away from this case for good. I think I contributed lots of small and not so small factual aspects of it. The things that actually happened that we write about in the book, I think most sounding like fiction, is that on the first night of our first visit there, with inside of the base perimeter, we had what was for me a shattering, multiple UFO incident, and audio taped it as it was happening. Those audio tapes over the years being voice stress analyzed on two separate occasions by two. It went on for an hour and a half, and it was still going on when we walked out of the area. We were literally still jet lagged. We'd landed the day before. And I had been doing, and I know you didn't intend to allow this show to be a dialogue on the death of Lefty Gate or something.
No, definitely not.
But I'm glad to be talking to you about it. The in February, as you know, from somebody who's very familiar with the book, factual matter, from the summer of 87 until February of 88, I was doing what I would call author standard armchair research. You're home, you're reading books, you're reading articles. I don't remember going online. Was there a line quite to go on quite yet? I don't think so.
Probably not, no.
But we get to England, and literally the day that we arrive on our first visit to the first visit, which I think is going to be our only visit to the location, not 5 or 6 miles away, we have this event. I know I went into shock at a certain point. I had studied shock as part of my qualifications for becoming a Samaritan, better known in the UK than the US. And I guess in a way, for somebody looking for somebody to write this story with, story being both meanings, a story and a story, he couldn't have picked anybody better than me in terms of my character and the way that I tend to see people, see the best first, and take that for granted unless I find out otherwise.
We all try to do that, Peter, don't we? You know.
Yeah. And by sheer coincidence, I think, the best thing that could have happened to my co-author was that night, because now I was something I had not wanted to be, which was part of the story. I wanted to chronicle somebody else's story. It's a very different way to approach a nonfiction book. And I wanted to keep out of it. But all of a sudden, I was part of it. Mm. And I could lean into what I had come to believe, which was this had happened to Larry. He had post-traumatic stress. Any crazy or questionable thing that he did could be clocked to that. Drinking too much. And that's how it went on for years. I always fell back on that until it started to fall apart. So there you have it.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel that he was shocked on that particular night with when you saw the UFO also?
Oh yeah. No question about it. Again, completely objectively, two independent parties over several years did voice stress analysis. You can, be a trained actor and sound like you're under real stress. Mm. Ultimately, it will register in somewhat different ways. Anyway, they came up fine. So it was just something quite extraordinary. Again, it's Suffolk, high incidence. Mysteries will confound me for the rest of my life. And I've come to think, like the wider UFO phenomena, this is accounted for by a number of possible aspects of paranormal and UFO rationale, as you know, we've studied for so many years.
Mm. Well, you probably know, I lived in Suffolk, not far from Rendlesham, for about 9 years. And I've spent plenty of evenings up at Rendlesham Woods or the forest, and I've seen quite a few anomalous things of myself. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
I believe we've seen
UFOs too. We've seen sort of stars that are stopped stationary and all of a sudden start moving again. So all sorts of things like that.
That forest is even really dispassionately, objectively, scientifically speaking, it's a live wire piece of real estate. I mean, yeah. It really is.
I mean, it raises the question with me. Do you think the base was actually put there for that purpose? Because it was near the woods that they knew, I keep saying the woods, the forest, that they knew things were happening there. Yeah, and the whole area maybe.
Well, it's important to remember, number one, that the Rendlesham Forest is not some ancient forest of British lore. It was planted, a little over 100 years ago as a timber forest. So, that aspect aside, also in my studies about the life of James Farsall, America's first Secretary of Defense. He was the man that President Roosevelt early on put in charge of overseeing aspects of Lend-Lease with His Majesty's government back then. And we know that that piece of real estate that became RAF Bentwaters, that was done under James Forrestal.
I didn't even know that. What?
And maybe in 42, I forget the year, but it was early on in the war. And that lease, it was the Army Air Corps, but ultimately the United States Air Force that stayed at that location for so many years. So, no, I don't think that was why it happened. It was more just the way that things went in history during the war.
Yeah, because we hear a lot about the witchcraft and all that in the area, and people.
Well, was one of the most interesting and at times engaging, exciting, weird for me parts of the research, and I'm proud of that research in the book too.
Yeah,
it's. Especially for somebody outside of English culture, this is very exotic. In America, if something is old, depending on the part of the country, it's 200 years old, possibly 3, usually 100. Old in some places is 40 years.
Well, unless it's connected to the Native American Indians, of course, because which goes
well, back. Exactly. I'm talking about the Great White Invasion.
You're talking about modern America. Us Europeans going there and killing them all, basically. Isn't it? But,
sometimes the less said about that, the better.
I know, yeah.
One can only wonder.
We won't dwell on that part. But I don't know if you had a chance to listen to my last show with Brenda Butler.
It's of course on my page, and I will watch it, of course, because I'm Philip is a dear friend as well, and looking forward to reading the book.
Yeah, I was going to say that Brenda's had quite a history in the Rendlesham Forest, and she talks about portals and orbs and all sorts of strange things that have happened there over the years.
Well,
so I'm hoping to do a second show with her, which will go more into that aspect of it. We did concentrate on her book, Sky Crash, more or less, when I went to speak to her. But we are going to hopefully do another show about the history of Rendlesham Forest and her experiences there. So that should be interesting sometime. I'll probably do that in the spring or the summer.
But, a lot of thoughts come up for me while you just said that. First, of course, my first visit to the forest was in 1987. And well captured in my account in the book. It was quite exciting. And
and that was before the big storm. That was before the big storm, wasn't it? Or was it 87?
Just after.
Just after. Yeah.
And that was a big part of some of my thinking in the book. Mm. Unlike most Americans, I've been to the UK 20 or 25 times, and I have been in the Rendlesham Forest without question every time of year, every time of day and night, although never too much after midnight. I Brenda might have even been with us, but we were in the forest and we had walked up, that the road that we describe in the book, where you make the left at East Gate.
The East Gate, yeah.
And walked right to the end. I think there were 4 or 5, maybe 6 of us, several dogs, all good as far as I was concerned. And we get to the perimeter where they put up the fence, and we're standing there talking, and flashlights, torches, be able to see each other. And I said, just out of curiosity, for the heck of it, I'd like everybody to turn off their lights, and I'm going to take a flash picture into the dark, which I do, and then another and another. And son of a gun, there was smoke when at a time, there were smokers among us, but nobody was smoking. And I think 2 or 3 orbs. Mm-hmm. And up until that moment, orbs, yes, maybe, no, what, my initially the idea technically of lens flare, you know, within
sophisticated lens system. Or this or whatever. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and but people started reporting these things more and more, and for me, that crossover point in a smaller way, but akin to having that UFO experience in February of 87 in Suffolk with, you know, my co-author, those are life-changing to a larger or tinier degree. I've experienced that for myself now. Well, how about that?
Yeah, well, I've experienced that myself. You've got no smokers around you, and you take these pictures in the dark, and you get all these strange shapes in like a fog. And the orbs, I mean, I've seen plenty of orbs. I mean, normally you take a whole stream of pictures, maybe seven or eight pictures. Most of them will come out black. Then all of a sudden you'll get two or three, which with the orbs that come out in it. And it's usually after Brenda said, if you take a picture over in that direction, you'll get something, because she's a bit, what should we say? I guess psychic is the word to say in that direction. And, yeah, I mean, Brenda's got some amazing photos that I'm going to put on the Paranormal Dimensions page anyway during this week.
I don't think there's anyone, man, woman, older, younger, who has spent more time doing more work on what goes on in that forest than Brenda Butler.
No, exactly.
I mean, she was literally a legend when I first connected with her in 1987 or 88. And I was thinking in Sky Crash in the book, I met Brenda Butler for the first time. I could take the book off the shelf, but it was, I think, shortly before or at the same time I met Larry Warren. And I happened to have the original copy of Sky Crash, which I wanted her to sign. And we chatted briefly, and you know what? Let me grab that off the shelf. This is recorded, but it's really happening.
Yes, what? Yeah. I've only got the paperback version.
There you go.
I know it's hard to get the hardback version of it, but mine's already signed by Dot and everything in there.
I was lucky enough to get it. Ah, great. I have Brenda's handwritten address in there.
Oh, right, yeah.
A business card for the Cherry Tree Pub, which enters into Left at Eastgate story.
It does.
And I have Dot Street's business card. And I have an inscription for Peter. I hope you find what you're looking for. That's pretty prophetic.
It is. I mean, mine says, dear David, good luck. Keep searching, Brenda Butler. 7th of October 2016 was mine. So it tells you how far behind the times I was. and from Dot Street, my sweet friend David, watch the skies. We are not alone. Lots of love, Dot Street. But there's something to treasure, I must admit. I wish I could get a hardback version, but you just can't get them. Have you read any of the other books about Rendlesham since you?
Thank you first for just bringing us back to that subject, because my point was, in 2017, when I felt I really had to walk away from this case, I didn't have any more to contribute. I was literally burned out on it.
Yeah, no matter how you feel about it, excuse me for jumping in, Peter, you are still a very important person within the picture of Rendlesham. I mean, your research, you did an awful lot of research, right? You were taken in by someone. We were all taken in by someone. We all read the book, so we were all taken in and believed it. So you've got nothing to be ashamed of there, Peter.
Yeah, I know that. It's just that part of walking away from it and being fine with that, because there's a zillion other areas in UFO studies to, you know, preoccupy oneself with, was that I had no interest in reading anything else on it. I wished everyone involved legitimately well, all the great researchers who continue to turn information up, the witnesses who make themselves available, we know this was a very real series of events, a very important series of events that are complicated because of the multiple nights and the multiple witnesses, the multiple locations, and the wild card, although hardly out of the question, of being messed with, as I think, you know, Colonel Halt used the term. And I think that potentially involves anyone named, you know, throughout the story.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Well, I think everybody was messed with, you know, somewhere along the line. Yeah, I do agree.
So where pathologies end off, or cons, or people trying to create a sense that something happened that didn't, all the way to the most exotic explanations, I remain open to quite a number of possibilities. And again, I think part of it is sort of like the Kennedy assassination. There are so many layers of the onion to peel down, and so many credible and so many incredible facts and witnesses and allegations. I don't know. Maybe at some point I will have a little more interest if, you know, something breaks that really grabs my attention. And that's not to be confused with my love of the area. I love Suffolk. And it's a second home to me.
It's
in
a
some
beautiful
ways.
County, yeah.
And it's the part of England I've returned to more often than any other part, and always will. And I'm sure I'll be back there next year as well.
Yeah, I'm sure you will. Well, I suppose we can move on from that then. We'll leave Rendlesham alone now and maybe come back to it another time.
I would also say here, just an edit cut, you can really cut out that entire bit with Sky Crash. I realize it was like 4 or 5 minutes of, you know, just my, oh, let me get my copy of the book.
Yeah, yeah. No, don't worry about that. I'll sort that out.
Okay.
Apart from that, Peter, what have you been up to lately? Have you been reading any other exciting books on UFO? Because I know you do your own radio show as well now, which is very exciting for KTR.
I do. It's this month. I'll be on the air for 2 years doing a...
That's gone so quickly. Yeah.
I kind of, you know, post-pandemic time senses have shifted to a degree. We don't perceive things quite the same anymore, I think. but yeah, I started in late December 2 years ago. And I'm proud of what I'm doing there. The show is called Meanwhile Here on Earth, and it broadcasts live on Monday nights. 7 to 9 Eastern Standard Time, that's PM, midnight to 2 a.m. your time, Greenwich Mean. But then it's archived, of course, and people can listen or watch. And like you, I have on guests, you know, who interest me or who are kind of in the UFO news, so to say, or historically so. But more and more, I realized that the format that I put together is somewhat unique. And because it's a 2-hour show, often with just one person, it can be pretty revealing. And we usually begin with, we know who you are, you know, if it's somebody in public life, you know, paranormal or whatever. But we really, of course, don't know who you are.
Yeah.
Can you, you know, we admire your work, your films, your books, your whatevers. How did you become the person you became, and give them an opportunity, should they wish, to literally tell the story of their life? And many have, and at times with very moving, surprising, shocking, funny, sad, you name it, like just like real life, often illustrated, sometimes not. And I've just been very moved by many of them. And because I have other interests besides this, and I think that anyone, bless their hearts, who like us
is a serious student of this area of unknown. Hopefully you have other interests as well, too.
Oh, absolutely. I know I've been through periods otherwise we'd go crazy, wouldn't we? People think we're crazy anyway.
Early on, I know when I was still obsessed with this subject, and it took a bit of time to work that through and just have it as opposed to it have me, that I, growing up in New York, loving the theater, working in the theater, working in the arts, being a painter, an artist, and loving to read and growing up in a reading family, that I'm reading, you know, UFO books, of course, as I always do, but certainly other books completely, you know, fiction, nonfiction, but having nothing whatsoever to do with the subject. And I'm very thankful about that.
That's right.
Can I
ask you a question? Yes. Sorry, please carry on.
No, ask me the question.
No, I was going to say, I'm lucky in the fact that with this show, because it's pre-recorded, I can actually chop things out. Do you find when you're doing a live show, you may have trouble keeping it going, or you can't chop anything out, or do you have anything that you'd like to have been chopped out?
Every once in a while, but, you know, I kind of think of it as a thinking person's auto race. Somebody could crash and burn. And that makes for really interesting live broadcasting. And then, of course, it's, you know, like any, it becomes a podcast de facto just by definition because, well, and I'm willing to risk that. And every once in a while with some guest, there can be a bit of a lull. Yeah. Usually not. And I have had people who have, I think, surprised themselves at times by speaking about things that they thought they weren't going to, and other people making us laugh hysterically with some story that they had never told in, you know, any public forum, and a few people completely breaking down, and for all the right reasons. But I've expanded the format in that hope, in that belief that those of us who are obsessed enough about the subject that we listen to programs like yours or mine and all the other ones, you know, that are out there, that they also have other interests. And I like to jog that every once in a while, and have had as guests painters, filmmakers, authors of different kinds of books, actors, playwrights, directors, one Hollywood level filmmaker, screenwriters, a museum curator, photographers, often, but not always, with an interest or involvement in UFOs or some other area of paranormal studies.
That is quite a selection.
You know, it's the other thing that I do is I've had a number of really memorable panel discussions on one aspect of, you know, what we do, or a case or an individual or a story, or sometimes they're really hyper-specific. I think it was last year or early this year that I had a panel of four women who are public figures in UFO studies, who are also mothers, who are also abductees, and who are also writers. And it was a really interesting study. Halloween, because it fell on a Monday this year, I had four friends, colleagues come on, all well qualified in their own ways, to talk about Halloween, one being our dear friend Sasha Christie.
Who
stayed up late.
I'll catch up with that one.
Very good sport, and added some wonderful bits about Halloween.
Sasha's got some amazing stories, yeah.
Yes, exactly. and right now, I'm going to continue to do what I do. I also am doing a once a month podcast now, I'm pleased to report, on Paranormal Panorama Network. And that's called UAP Global Perspective. And this month, my guest is Don Schmidt, one of the most esteemed American researchers.
He has been on this show a couple of years ago, actually. Well, probably about 3 years ago now.
A great He's a great guy, but also a wonderful professional in the field and a great author.
He's a real Roswell expert, isn't he, basically?
Yeah.
So, exactly.
Yeah. And it's funny. I read among the stuff that I read for enjoyment. In the 80s, I was really bitten with espionage fiction and just ate up all I could get. And of course, most of the best authors on the subject are in the UK. And so I started to read the different ones. And I think one of my all-time favorite authors is John Le Carré. He's certainly my all-time favorite espionage author.
Well, we are the home of James Bond, aren't we? So,
yeah. Well, he leaves James Bond in the dust. I was a fan of James Bond. I read my first James Bond novel when I was 17, and of course could enjoy the great tongue-in-cheek and, you know, embarrassingly sexist, you know, kind of cartoon.
They were very sexist, yeah.
That Bond was, and I, you know, it's another time, another place. It was meant in a different spirit. The way that Bond has been reinvented, to go off on a real tangent here, is interesting. You know, Sean Connery is not Daniel Craig's James Bond, but
in his day, anyway, he was the best. But yeah, that's right.
Earlier this year, I got an email from an author saying, I'm writing detective fiction. And I understand from some interview I heard with you that you're interested. Can I send you the book that I wrote? And he did. And it's a cop novel. And the more I read it, the more I thought, this is good. It's engaging me as a story. It's courageous in that it's dealing with a cold case murder that has to do with sexual abuse within the church. And I thought it was all well handled. I liked the characters. And he said, I've just finished a manuscript for, it's a police mystery, it's a murder mystery, but the thing that sets off the murder is somebody possibly unwinding the original 1947 cover-up of, you know, the whole UFO thing. And it's all set in Dayton, Ohio and Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And then he said, I was born in Dayton. I grew up there. For years, I lived a mile from the base. Hector Quintanilla, Major Hector Quintanilla, who was the last head of Project Blue Book before they closed it, was the father of like his best friend growing up.
Wow.
And as a school assignment, at one point, he was invited, he had to interview somebody. And he interviewed his friend's dad. Anyway, all this informs the book. I read it and I thought, this is a surprise. It's a detective novel and you shouldn't expect it to be more, but he has it really well referenced. And it is called Blue Book. And the author's name is Tom Harley Campbell. You can find it on Amazon. I definitely like it, wrote a blurb for it, and I'm doing what I can to let folks know, just because it is a rare bird. You know, if you're like me and you like espionage or police detective novels, here's one that really did its homework.
What was the title of the one you were reading out to him there, Peter? The first title you said, it was Satan something, wasn't it? The first title you held, I saw the title, but...
This has zero to do with UFOs. It's just the same
place. Choir.
Yeah. And it's a good detective novel. And speaking about good detective novels, I am almost finished with one by maybe my favorite British detective novelist, the great P.D. James. You are into whodunit mysteries, and you want to read the best? She's there.
For anyone listening on the radio here, I'm talking to Peter on video, and he's got a big stack of books by the side of him. And he's...
Right. We do need to remember our radio guest. This was, I think, one of the most important books in UFO-related studies to come out this year, a book called The Believer, Alien Encounters, Hard Science, and the Passion of John Mack. Is written by a lifelong journalist, in fact, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times for more than 50 years, Ralph Blumenthal. And in fact, he and his team received the Pulitzer Prize for their investigative work on the first World Trade Center bombing, the one in, I think, 91 or so, where seven people were killed and, you know, they did $500 million worth of damage, but they didn't realize that this was the first. Anyway, it's a really outstanding biography of John and John Mack. And for those who don't know who John Mack is, he was very involved in UFO abduction studies, courageously so, considering that he is a distinguished professor of psychiatry at Harvard, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of actually a psychological biography of T.E. Lawrence. He's an authority on teenage suicide, co-founder of the Cambridge Hospital in Boston psychiatric wing, and courageous UFO pioneer. And it's the first real biography I've ever read of any, you know, serious substance of somebody who was a friend of mine, who, you know, I knew. But then you realize you knew that much of them. And it's a very good account also of how he went up against Harvard with the great Danny Sheehan as his attorney to essentially justify his belief in what, you know, potentially might be embarrassing to Harvard or, you know, cultish or nonsense or whatever. And it's the first time it happened there since the 60s when Timothy Leary was called on the carpet there for his UFO-related pronouncements, and he was canned. But John was welcomed back with open arms and continued his good work. One of the most important UFO books to be published this year, I'm not overstating the fact, is written by a British author. And if you are not aware of it, you need to be. It's called Out of Time, and the author is Steve Aspin, A-S-P-I-N. I had known Steve for 15 years as a friend before I knew that he had written this manuscript, which he kind of surprised me with when I stayed with him and his wife in May. Somebody hands you a manuscript, you know, actually or allegorically, and if you know them, you hope it's good, so it won't be embarrassing. If you don't like it, if they're a friend, you really hope that's the case.
Yeah, you hope you do, Lord, yeah.
And I read the introduction, and I was quite taken aback. Steve had confided things to me over the years, which I never shared with anyone other than Bud Hopkins at Steve's request. And ultimately, Steve and Bud became very close. But he had had experiences since he was young. And his account is unlike anything we have in print because nobody like Steve has ever written a book like this. He is a retired businessman living in England, and he had a good education. His father was a professor. His childhood was, I guess, upper middle class. And his approach to writing the book was, I don't want to say too much about it. There is a website for, I think it's outoftime.com. All I can say is it's the best personal account and best documented, and then the best, if you have never picked up a UFO-related book in your life, the abduction phenomenon is probably not the place to start. This book is, though. because he goes out of his way in a scholarly, compact, and accurate way to create two capsule histories of major cases in the world of, you know, post-war UFOs and major individual abductee situations and individuals. And it's what you need at the least, but it's fine to go forward with that, to take in his account and then the appendices and the physical evidences and the analyses, et cetera. I'd call it the UFO book of the year. And I think, and with respect and affection to all of my friends and colleagues who are experiencers and authors who have written something of their own accounts, I think this is the best one ever published in England. And for all the right reasons, this is an unpaid endorsement, but I am that impressed with this book.
Yeah.
Out of Time by Steve Aspen, available on Amazon.
Yeah. Well, upon your recommendation, that's just gone to the number one on my to buy list. So, and I'll actually put a link to that on the Paranormal Dimensions page as well. So everyone can see what we're talking or what you're talking about. Excellent. I know you've spoken about abductions before and with your work with Bud Hopkins. I don't know if we didn't cover too much about your work with Bud Hopkins, I don't think. But you were involved with him for quite a few years, weren't you, Peter? Is there any sort of cases that stand out to you with Bud?
Yeah. I first met Bud Hopkins in 1976, less than a year after I had become involved in the work. I had read his first published article, and I thought it was the best thing I'd ever read on the subject. Most of what I was seeing was, tabloid kind of news coverage and pulp UFO magazines that were not necessarily really high quality or terribly accurate.
I think we all started there.
Yeah. Well, if you're younger, you don't know what we're talking about. And the New York art world was small enough that I knew there was late period abstract expressionist. I think I'd seen his work in a group show some years before named Bud Hopkins. And this author who wrote this amazing case, which I think was brought him to instant attention in the UFO world in the States. It was MUFON declared it the case of the year for 1975. I cold called him from the phone book. We were both painters. I was teaching at the School of Visual Arts, not far from where he lived in Lower Manhattan. Introduced myself and told him I had been studying this stuff and I'd had childhood sighting, but my sister seems to have been taken. And his very first question to me was, tell me about your artwork. And that didn't go really well. I was coming out of a conceptual minimalist time and school, and he was, an old school painter. But he was interested in what happened to my sister, invited me over, and we had coffee in his kitchen, talked about art, life, and UFOs. And it was the beginning of a friendly acquaintanceship. And over the next few years, we would just get together a few months for that. And we met 5 years before he published his first book. So it kind of grew together, and we did our very first talks together in 1977 on the same stage with that witness from his first case. But I do remember a number of cases, and there were, using the word case, it's so dispassionate, we're talking, of course, about human lives, and in some cases, the shattering or beatific or strangest, frightening, or wonderful things that have ever happened to them. And a case could mean a memorable letter from somebody that he got back in touch with and maybe referred to somebody else, or somebody who, he would work with for years in interviews and sometimes hypnotic regression, sometimes with building, you know, supporting evidence. First case I really remember with him was working with my sister, and at least to the satisfaction of all of us, confirming as well as anybody could that what she was remembering was genuinely what she felt was happening and had happened. I guess the biggest one for me was the so-called Brooklyn Bridge UFO incident. Arguably one of the most complex and challenging, in that even in a world of UFO abduction and all that goes with it, this one to some people seems particularly far-fetched because it happened in an urban area. Well, that's, you know, that's the way it is as much as in the countryside. But in lower Manhattan, you know, early in the morning, with witnesses seeing a woman floated out of through a plate glass window on the 10th floor, as I recall, of her building near the Brooklyn Bridge, into a glowing UFO that then dove into the East River. And the story continued from there. It involves also an important diplomat. One can say, well, I've heard about it, it doesn't sound right to me, or I read the book and I still have my questions. Well, I worked that case with Bud to a degree, and Linda irregularly, as I was needed, over 6 years. Six years. I saw the evidence coming in. And one of the most exciting things was, you know, of course, there's always people that's going to say, and I'm a good example, you know, somebody's perpetrating a hoax. The letters that you're getting, so what, they are all seemingly in different handwritings and different postmarks with different styles of witness drawings. You know, I'm guessing if they were doing DNA analysis back then, you could have taken a stamp off and analyzed, you know, the spit on the back of the stamp. But it was really incredibly moving, and understandably anxiety provoking at times as the story developed. Then you remember, I remember in the complete other direction, every once in a while, something happens in case investigation that's genuinely funny. And I remember one young woman Bud was working with, who certainly seemed to be a lifelong abductee, described a part of a recent abduction when she hears, you know, telepathic voice in her head, we love you, you know, whatever. But then she hears this being say, we love you. You know, I love you. We love you, we're your parents. We love you, we're your parents. And she's not stupid. And she responds, you're not my parents. It's quiet for a moment. And this is, you know, she's just saying what happened, but she remembers. The response is, we're your parents' best friends. Every once in a while, also, an individual is rare, but it happened. And we kept the, they were always smart enough in the few cases where it happened to throw it in a plastic bag and, you know, not do it. They would have an abduction experience and they would be back in bed and find themselves dressed in something different than they had worn to sleep. If they wore a nightgown, they're wearing a big T-shirt or whatever. I guess they make mistakes too. Mostly, though, because I witnessed quite a number of hypnotic regressions at Bud's request, with the permission and encouragement of the individual, or at their request if it was somebody that I knew, and it was always okay with Bud. And Hypnosis now, and I know you're very familiar with it, regressive hypnosis in the service of investigating a UFO case, is often frowned upon, highly controversial, often criticized, a standard argument being there's coercion, even if it's subtle, you can't trust the practitioner, there's probably an agenda here, or witness testimony can't be trusted, and remembered witness testimony in a situation where you're supposed to be in shock. I think what it really depends on is the same thing it depends on in other areas of using hypnotic regression to help you stop smoking or something. Number one, although of course we're talking about apples and oranges here, the practitioner really does have to be an ethical, well-trained, empathetic person. There's no faking that. They also need to have your needs and your privacy and doing this in your service as well as learning more while they're doing it. And that has to be the priority. Everything has to be done with permission. Everything needs to be recorded. I know that by the time Bud stopped doing regressions as his health deteriorated, we had logged in something like 800 separate audio cassettes over the years. And all the records were kept, as pretty Dickensian, in two ledgers that I cross-referenced. One, the individual, the day, the time, and the other, I'm trying to remember if it was by subject or anyway, many of them were repeat. Others were intake interviews with an individual or members of their family, or in some cases where they encouraged us to do it or was available with a medical or mental health professional, et cetera. And in some ways, they kind of blend together. Other ways, you know, remember distinct personalities. Another one who went on to become quite well known was Deb White Cabell, going under the pseudonym of Kathy Davis in Bud's, I think it's one of the very best case histories of an abduction ever published, still, Intruders, The Incredible Visitations in Copley Woods. That's available, you know, new and used. All
yeah, I've got it here.
And in fact, Robbie Graham's wonderful publishing company, Autumn Night Press, as I recall. Am I right there? I hope so. They have a wonderful new edition of Intruders out, as well as Missing Time. Both have been out of print for years. And Deb White Cabell's own auto memoir about Intruders. But Deb was, you know, basically a Midwestern American who this was happening to, and who came to New York to, because she's this, that beside herself, from Indiana. And, you know, was welcomed with open arms and became part of that group of people who were drawing support from each other, that these things had happened. And it was always an honor and a privilege to kind of be in the middle of it as somebody that it hadn't happened to in my, you know, role as Bud's assistant, which basically went on and off from the early 80s until 2000, and stopped really rather suddenly when my sister died. And I think it was probably, I mean, I stopped in at one point within a matter of weeks, but it was about a year before I was together enough to return to work. And by then, very appropriately, Bud had trained one of the other Intruders Foundation board members to do what I was doing, and he was doing great. And so for the last 10 years of Bud's life, our relationship returned to how it was the first 5 years or so. when occasionally I might work as his studio assistant as an artist, but otherwise getting together, you know, every 3 months or so,
for a coffee,
having a drink or talking about life, art, and UFOs. I miss him very much. Great contributor to the field.
He seems a sort of man I'd like to have met myself, but so I never got a chance. But
he's one of those people who falls into that category of great guy as well as great man.
Yeah, the ones you don't get the chance to meet. Yeah, I mean, during those experiences, were there many descriptions of the aliens that abducted people come up? Talking about the greys and reptilians, et cetera.
That is a great question. And we kept no formal statistics, but of course the drawings started to come in and, you know, the accounts that were given. I'm grabbing this out of the air, but I would say 70 to 80% of the descriptions were within parameters archetypical grays. The other 20% or so varied wildly. Again, in, as you'd imagine, insectoids, reptoids. Bud's real focus. You know, we all get into a groove in a certain way, especially if you're involved in, I mean, this is such a massive field to try to even perceive. I know after more than 40 years of being caught up to one degree or another, not just in the world of UFO studies, but abductions, I still find myself, I don't know about you, several times a year, just sometimes out of nowhere going, this is really happening. This is not any of the stuff that's been presented to me over time. It's not sleep paralysis. It's not watching a scary movie the night before. It's not psychosis. It's this is really happening. And I hope I never stop doing that, because, you know, and seeing yourself as somebody who does this as a routine and just, you know, another person who was taken away by other intelligences, you know, as their parents, grandmother, great-grandmother, who knows. Yeah. That's another thing that I think is very elucidating in Steve Aspin's book, Out of Time, which is the overwhelming number of authentic, I think, case histories virtually always involve, if it's learned, that this has happened to one of both of your parents, which is shocking in itself. Especially given that back in like the 1970s, before serious scientific studies of the abduction phenomena were happening, or, you know, there were no leading researchers in the field because it was embarrassing. It's okay to talk about the cars, but not the drivers.
You, like me, you've spoken to many people who have been involved in abductions. You've probably spoken to a lot more than me. I mean, I'm very convinced that it goes on. I mean, I don't know if I've ever been abducted, because sometimes you don't lose, you know, you don't have that memory. But as I say, you must have spoken to many more people than I do. So I definitely know it exists. There was some. I actually was lucky enough to meet Whitley Strieber a few weeks back, when he came to Manchester. And I was quite taken aback when he actually mentioned that he'd got involved with Bud Hopkins and he'd been talking to him about his experiences.
Well, the story, going back to either 1986 or early, no, it was 86, Whitley Strieber, then a very well-known fiction writer here in the States, kind of like a demi Stephen King, very good at that kind of gothic fiction. I've read a number of his books. Contacted Bud Hopkins and told him about the experiences that he and his family and friends had had at their place upstate and like that. And he was very troubled by them. Also, he was not keen on this being public information, being a public person. And in fact, he's more than troubled. He at one point and I'm not talking out of school here. It's simply on the record. He was suicidal.
Yeah, it's a serious breakdown. Yeah. And his marriage broke up and everything, yeah.
Very poignant stuff. I mean, this can do it, no question. Anybody that thinks not is being kind of cavalier. Anyway, he wrote this manuscript for a book that became Communion and had it professionally proofread. But apparently, first getting to know Bud and working with him and visiting Bud at his studio and office, never when I was there, he knew who I was. And he knew that I not only worked, you know, for Bud and with Bud, but we had confidence we shared with each other. And this was one. And of course, I never spoke to anyone about it, but I was really interested when Bud told me that this writer whose work I knew was writing or had written the manuscript. Anyway, what caught me off guard was before it went to press, Whitley asked Bud if he knew anybody. Again, it had been professionally proofread, you know, for spelling and typos and grammar and all that. And Whitley's a professional writer, so I'm sure there are bloody few. But he asked Bud if there was anybody he knew to do a final read of the book who was a good enough editor, who took the subject seriously and could maintain a confidence. And Bud said, yeah, call Peter. And so very shortly after, got this cold call from Whitley Strieber. And he said, I'll come right to the point. I know you know what's been happening with me over these months. I know that Bud has shared this stuff with you. And could you read this manuscript and let me know what you think? Well, of course, I was incredibly flattered. And I said, yes, immediately. You know, this is where to send it. He said, no. He said, there's one printed copy. And it's not leaving my home. What I need is for you to come over here on a morning where you have a free day and have breakfast with me and my wife and my son. And then let us set you up in the guest room and bring you lunch and drinks and check in with you every once in a while. But to simply stay there until you finish the manuscript. Got to be done one sitting. And then let us know what you think. And then you're free to go. And I thought,
oh, you're a captive.
Of course. Are you kidding? This is going to be an interesting day. And they lived in a very nice loft apartment in the southeast corner of the famous Greenwich Village. And it was a lovely place filled with, I remember, some very memorable and some very strange art. And I was in a very comfortable room. And I read it carefully. I made a few notes. I think I took about 8 hours. I could have speed read it, of course, but I had meal breaks and I really did want to take it all in. And I finished about 8 in the evening, I think. And they went into the living room and I told them what I thought, which was very good. I did feel that it would benefit maybe from a little more just going over it with a slightly, my point being that Whitley was still in therapy as he was working on the book. And I had been in serious therapy some years before, got great benefit out of it. And just my suggestion, he obviously felt that was not necessary, and the world has validated that because I think the book probably went to the printer the next day. Yes. And it is, you know, it's a classic, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, what a recommendation, eh? Well, wow. No, so I was actually surprised when the name Buck Hopkins came up. I was like, well, what a connection there is there.
Well, again, I think the book is dedicated to Bud. And it was Bud who ironically introduced Whitley to the artist who created the cover, which helped to sell that book in the millions. Mm. And it set up a very interesting phenomena. And I'm going to close with this, that I've never been, I don't think has ever happened with another UFO related book. It was a smash bestseller in the UK, in the US, in quite a number of countries around the world. I don't remember how many translations it went into, but I'm guessing at least 15. Some of them very lucrative, and others, you know, very modest revenue streams for Whitley. But Bud, over the next couple of years, got at least several hundred letters. I will stand on that. And Whitley, you'd have to ask him, but I wouldn't be surprised if he got, you know, hundreds more than Bud, saying in so many words, I saw, you know, Whitley Strieber's book in the bookstore, and I either had to buy it, or it scared me, or it made me feel weird, or I had to pick it up, or I had to go away. But blah, blah, blah. The one that I saw, chin wasn't so pointy, eyes were different shape, didn't have a nose. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people contacting people like Bud and Whitley to say no. It was almost like that. And in doing so, making it the more archetypical gray as a rule, that cover was a cover. It was done by a professional illustrator, you know, not to be accurate, but to have people stop for a moment and maybe pick up a book. That's key marketing.
Could it not be that they're like us, that we don't all look alike, although we are physically alike. We don't all look exactly alike, do we? So maybe the greys don't all look exactly alike, the same as us.
Also true.
You know, it's just an interesting aspect of it. But, I just thought I'd throw that one in, Peter. You've been doing some talks also recently about the UFO ridicule part of ufology. Would you like to sort of mention a bit about that, what you've been talking about?
I'd be glad to. In fact, your timing is fortuitous because a illustrated print version of the subject boiled down is in this month's issue of Outer Limits magazine.
All right. And
it's a subject that first came up for me early on in my interest in the subject in general and kept coming back, which was, how did it happen that the entire Western world in a matter of a month or so bought the crazy proposition that somebody's saying words to the effect of, I saw something in the sky or some things in the sky last night or yesterday afternoon that I had never seen anything like before, either because of their shape, their movement, their size, their whatever. And I wonder what they were. End of statement. What logical, sane, you know, not brain dead person would not either say or think, gee, that's interesting to some degree. I wonder what it was to. End of story, right? How did it happen that somebody would say something like that or allege something like that and you'd see their mouth move, but what you'd ultimately hear in your head was, is this person delusional? Do they want to hoax me? Are they looking to be famous? Do they want to feel special? Are they mentally ill? Are they a con man? Are they some kind of mystic? Is this a cult? It's absolutely, it makes no sense at all. It's insane in a certain level, but it happened. And it happened very quickly in the summer of 1947 here, and then basically was transposed over to the UK, and the ridicule set in. And I thought about and think about it every once in a while, every number of years, but finally it really started to get to me. And so I researched it more. And then it became a really interesting kind of detective story because it was the media who set it in motion, but on their own. And if not, if not, who did set it in motion? Who had the power to set in motion? Why would they set it in motion? How did it work for so well for so long until it started to come undone just a few years ago in December? Kicked off in December of 2017. And the ridicule factor, as I'm sure you'll agree, you know, the old wink, wink, nudge, nudge, I'm just reading the news, folks, or, you know, it's dissipated dramatically. In fact, it's now much more the rule that our news readers read it as that kind of story as respectfully as they would any other serious news story. And that's good. That is changing. But I developed it into a conference talk and gave versions of it, as you saw, although that one did not go well for me.
that wasn't your fault, though, was it?
No, it was my fault. It was in that without thinking, I asked my friend to print it out for me, and they said both sides okay. And I said, sure, which I never do. And, you know, we get into habits, and I lost my place twice. Yes,
that's quite easy.
Well, anyway, it worked better before and after.
It was still good, Peter, whatever you say.
Anyway, it really is an interesting subject, and people either are interested in history or they're not. Usually, you know, if I chat with people that have no interest in history, it's usually because they had some insanely boring teacher at an impressionable time in their life, and history is just dead and it's in the past anyway. And so what the hell? We got plenty of stuff right now to deal with. But of course, those who do not understand history are condemned to repeat it. George Santayana, the great Spanish philosopher. And for me, this is important. Early on, setting in motion the whole UFO cover-up history. And even if we can't do anything about it now, if I'm right or if part of what I'm proposing is correct, we at least have a chance to understand why it happened and why, you know, these people who, for most of my life, I've villainized, how dare you, you know, not tell us what's going on, blah, blah, blah. You know, you have face the opportunity to look at it from their point of view at that moment in the summer of 1947. And
yeah. So you feel that the government and the CIA and also all these sort of people were actually had some sort of a vendetta against the UFO people to try and quell all these stories of UFOs.
Well, I'm talking specifically about June and July of 1947, and there wasn't any CIA.
That's true.
That happened a few months later in September, but without giving it completely away.
It was the OSS there, wasn't it?
I don't think major media, you know, the key people, the owners, the publishers, the head editors said, I've got an idea. Here's this really interesting, slightly anxiety-provoking news story, and it's happening more and more every day over parts of the United States and other countries. Let's cover the story. Oh, no. Let's make a joke of it.
Yeah.
Let's just make a joke of it and destroy its credibility. That'd be fun. It makes no sense at all. And who and what within officialdom set it in motion, how it worked or how it might have worked, was what I zoned in on. And I hope people will find it of interest. Again, it's in the current issue of Outer Limits magazine, available on cyber newsstands near you.
Do you intend to expand on that and maybe write a full book about it, Peter? It might be an idea. No?
Nope. I consider what I've done expanded and onto some other things that I'm working on right now.
Excellent. What can you? Anything you can tell us about?
Working away on a book, which will be out probably sometime the second half of next year. Laying out plans for another book, which is not UFO related, neither of which I'm going to talk about right now. But a couple, you know how it is in terms of all the maybes that come at you in this work, in terms of a possible consulting job or whatever. And it's just the nature of the business. They usually don't work out, but you know, you do your best and take it seriously. And I've got a couple of irons in the fire, and I hope one of them will work out in terms of some film work coming up, consulting on other projects. And again, therefore,
on the Travis Walton. Hello, you still? Oh, sorry.
Hi,
Peter's on the phone.
Sorry about that.
Well, I'm going to leave it in, Peter.
Why not?
No, it's
anyway.
No, I was going to ask you about the Travis Walton story. You were involved in the DVD documentary, were you not?
Yes, I was an associate producer and introduced Travis to Jennifer Stein, who was the filmmaker who made it. It came out, I think, now more than 5 years ago.
It is, but, Well, I'll also have a question about that in a moment. But
I will always be very proud of it. It was really Jennifer and our cameraman, Bob Terrio, who did the lion's share of the work. And Jennifer kept going back and winning the trust of and making contact with and filming more and more of the individuals involved, getting more and more archival footage, and ultimately bringing in a number of really interesting authorities on various things that would naturally relate to the case, from Travis's psychology to we have Ben Hansen, who is a retired FBI profiler who now works in television, talking about the odds of beating not just a polygraph, but of repeatedly beating it and having your five cohorts. It just was off the chart, as well as the physical evidence, as well as the very human evidence. And this was before many people were using drones in documentaries. And there's some brilliant drone footage in this. Again, it's called Travis, The True Story of Travis Walton. And you can either find it online as a download or buy the DVD. Yeah. But it's a great UFO documentary. Great.
Yeah. Now, the question I was going to ask you, I've heard a rumor that they're going to actually make another movie about it. Is that true? Like a closer to the actual story movie? I don't know if you've heard anything about it.
Travis?
Yeah.
Well, it's something he's wanted to do since the film, before the film came out, because of how the onboard sequences were compared to what he actually recalled. And that was absolutely no fault of Travis's or the screenwriter. What happened was, once they were on location, everything was cast. They had their script locked down. They were starting filming. I'm blanking right now on the screenwriter, Tracy Torme, good friend, blah moment. I should be drinking coffee instead of tea. Tracy Torme, who also wrote a very moving, now a little dated, but still very powerful miniseries for American television, Intruders, kind of a take, not fully accurate, on Bud Hopkins' best-known book. They're there, and they get a call from the head of the studio, a now-deceased jerk named Brandon Tartikoff, who says they have to stop filming and change that sequence.
Yeah.
Torme does his best to explain that it's just the way it was. Mm-hmm. And that's really exciting enough. Apparently, Tartikoff had seen something on TV, possibly even the treatment in Intruders, that for him was somehow similar to what really happened to Travis, as that is the case. And he wanted some new, scary, weird thing going on there. And Travis came on and they, you know, basically stated their case. And he said, in so many words, if you don't do this now, I will close down the set. I'll take the $10 million loss or whatever it is, put 20 odd people out of work and cut off, you know, money for that their breadwinners would be earning. And he had to rewrite the scene.
Wow.
So who can blame Travis? For me, there were parts of the film that worked.
Absolutely. It's a great film. It's just that Travis wasn't very happy with the ending of it.
Well, and with that wasn't the ending. It was, you know, the onboard experience. But a lot of us would love to see.
Not the ending. Like us, well, you know, that experience itself. I know I think the rest of the film was actually quite close to the characterizations of all the people in it. But,
and some very good acting as well. And I kind of sentimental aspect, but James Garner's characterization of Sheriff Gillespie, I thought was particularly good. and the real Sheriff Gillespie, who in fact took UFOs very seriously. He had his own incident, but for understandable reasons was not comfortable speaking about it on camera. I thought Garner did a very good job of him not being fully convinced that it hadn't happened, but assuming that
he became more convinced as it went along, didn't he?
Yeah. You're a law enforcement officer. You're in Arizona. You're in a very macho culture, to put it mildly. Flying saucers and little green men, not so good.
Yeah, yeah. No, I just wondered if you'd heard anything about a new version being made. I mean, I've been lucky enough to meet Travis a couple of times. And he's an absolute gentleman. I know he's a good friend of yours as well.
If there are developments on it, I'm not aware of them, but I hope there are.
Yeah, it'd be great if they did a proper, another. Because I think there's been time enough now that's gone past since the original version. We've lost James Golden in between times, and I think it could well be done. It'd be good to have another version of it. Anyway, Peter, I mean, thank you so much for finding the time to come on. I know you're very busy and everything. So next year we'll be seeing you at the Outer Limits magazine.
You bet.
Is it September or so, or August?
It is September. I don't remember September. The day, but I believe it's a Saturday. And if you go, I'm sure, to Outer Limits magazine Facebook page, website, you'll find it in a second.
This is for people out there. I should have actually took a note of it, I'll put a note on the Paranormal Dimensions page anyway.
Definitely.
It's in September, as I thought. I think it's a week after another event I've got to go to.
Yeah, check with Chris.
Yeah, that's right. I'll put a link on it anyway. So if anyone's interested in meeting Peter, which I'm sure everyone will be, and also you've got Ryan Sprague over here now, who's actually guesting as well. He's another good friend of yours.
Yes, he is. He is.
He's actually living here now, is he?
He's in Edinburgh. And boy, I'm very envious of that. I love Edinburgh, and what a wonderful opportunity to spend a good period of time in a city. His fiance is in a graduate program at the university there, so that's what's gotten him over.
It's an amazing city. I've only been here once, but I must go again. It's the castle's fantastic. Anyway, Peter, when you come over again next year, hopefully we'll get together for a drink and a meal and a talk.
Absolutely, David. Count on it. And please send my love to Jill, and both of you stay well.
Yeah, she's watching TV downstairs. So anyway, Peter, thank you ever so much for coming on, and I'll speak to you soon. Take care of yourself.
You too.
Thank you, Peter. Cheers. Take care. Bye.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye. Peter Robbins. That was fantastic. Thank you, Peter. And if you'd like the chance to meet Peter next year in September, when he'll be back over again in the UK, I think it's September the 23rd, and that will be the Outer Limits magazine conference, and that will be in Hull. And I believe it's September the 23rd, but I shall keep you in touch with that and let you know later on. And I will certainly put a link on the Paranormal Dimensions page. So if you haven't visited the Paranormal Dimensions page on Facebook, please do. Okay, as I mentioned, this is the final show of 2022. The first show in January of 2023 will be on the 2nd, and it will be paranormal investigator Ben Walgate. So we should look forward to that. So I hope you'll join me in the new year. I wish you all a very happy Christmas and a very happy new year, and take care, everybody. This is David Young signing out for 2022. Bye-bye, everyone.
Paranormal Dimensions is as bright and powerful as our celestial star, the Sun. And although it's expending thousands of pounds of energy every minute of the day, have no fear. There's plenty left.
Paranormal Dimensions is fortnightly on Mondays on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.